you, members of the panel. My name is Brett Gunnell. I'm an attorney with Sherman and Howard, registration number 24579, arguing on behalf of the appellants JW Construction and Mr. Riddick, Joe Riddick, personally. We've raised several legal issues in our briefing. I want to focus on two in argument. Of course, I'll address anything that members of the panel wish for me to address. The first legal issue I'd like to address is the personal liability that was extended to Mr. Riddick personally under the excessive lien statute. And then second, the misapplication of tort liability in violation of the recent developments in the economic loss rule. Turning first to the excessive lien statute, that of course is a statutory remedy. There is no such thing as a tort for excessive lien. It is purely a creature of statute created under our lien statute. It has specific language that exposes any person who files a lien to excessive or to liability for forfeiture of the lien and risk of attorney's fees, provided certain criteria is met. There's really no dispute here that JW Construction did the work on which the mechanics liens that were filed were based, that JW Construction was the party that contracted with the Elliots to build their $2 million custom home, and that under the court's findings, JW Construction was found to be liable for an excessive lien and attorney's fees. We don't contest that finding. But there is no basis to extend that finding of attorney's fees for violation of the statute to Mr. Riddick personally. And we know that the way that the court got there was simply by extending the joint and several liability that she had found in the underlying tort claims to this particular statutory remedy. But again, two things to remember. There is no such thing as a tort claim in Colorado for filing an excessive lien. And even if there was, it would not necessarily carry the risk of attorney's fees. The only way we get to the risk of attorney's fees is by simply importing joint and several liabilities from tort improperly into this statute.
Mr. Gunnell, part of the argument appears to be that Mr. Riddick was a signatory on the lien and because he signed it as president. Would you address that, please?
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, clearly, the statute does extend liability to a person that files a lien. We know in Colorado, we respect the fiction that corporations are distinct persons under the law from individuals. Somebody will always file a lien. It would come as a shock to my secretary to find out that she would be personally liable for an excessive lien if, in fact, she was the one who filed the lien. There are any officers and directors who may actually sign the lien on behalf of the corporation. If you look at the lien in the record, Mr. Riddick signed the lien in his capacity as president of JW Construction, not in an individual capacity. And there will always be someone that signs a lien and physically records a lien. That certainly cannot be what the legislature intended when they said that there would be liability for the person filing the lien. And what's clear here is the remedy that the Elliots got is sufficient. I mean, think of the remedy the legislature has provided. You forfeit the right to the mechanics lien entirely if there's a finding that was excessive. And on top of that, that entity or person filing the lien is exposed to attorney's fees. It would have been necessary to find at the trial court level, and there was no argument and no finding by the trial court, that Mr. Riddick was the alter ego of his corporation, JW Construction, in order to extend personal liability for the filing of an excessive lien. And so on this particular finding, the court should strike that finding from the trial court of personal liability and leave that remedy against JW Construction as the relief that the Elliots received for that finding at trial. I want to next turn to the economic loss rule and how it applies to invalidate tort claims that were found at trial. This actually is a case, a very good case of the very kind of mischief the economic loss rule is designed to avoid. It is a contract dispute. A general contractor working for a homeowner under a construction contract They argued about what was owed, they argued about a termination, and JW Construction lost that case at trial. We don't contest that on appeal. But recognize that the trial court found that there were no damages for breach of contract, and therefore awarded $1 in nominal damages. But as a result of the findings at trial, JW lost its right to finish the job and collect the agreed fixed price of the contract, $1.9 million, became liable for breach of contract, had their VIN damages, became liable for the Elliott's attorney's fees under a fee-shifting provision, and lost its lien rights as a result of losing in breach of contract.
Mr. Gundlett, excuse me for interrupting, but could you spend a minute or two just talking about the preservation issue here, which is addressed in the briefs, I know, and tell us your best argument about why we should even address this argument. And specifically, I'd like to know if you have any case law that says that if you raise this defense in your answer and or in the trial management order, that's enough as a matter of law to preserve it.
Your Honor, first let me address the latter part of that. I am not aware of and did not find any case law that indicated that only raising it as an affirmative defense in the trial management order would avoid the preservation argument on appeal. But going to the core of your argument, under Rule 1D, this court...
It's not an argument, it's a question.
Thank you. Going to the core of that question, Rule 1D obviously makes it discretionary. Now, I accept that the framework that this court and the Supreme Court has imposed is an unusual circumstances test, that you don't go to those issues that aren't properly preserved without unusual circumstances. I happen to believe and would suggest to the court that the four-factor test in the Lyons case that the Tenth Circuit adopted is a proper way to evaluate when there are unusual circumstances, and this court fits square, this case fits squarely within that test. The key to that test is really the first and the last factor, but it has to be a purely legal issue, because obviously we want to give trial courts the right to make a correct an error when they were in the unique position to evaluate witnesses and facts and demeanor. That's not the case on a de novo review. And then the more important is when there's been an intervening change of the law. And here, the Court of Appeals did redefine the boundaries of the economic loss rule after this trial was concluded, albeit 2 days after the trial. The Hammond case was issued, and then really during the time of the post-trial briefing, the Makota case was handed down. And it's in those kind of circumstances where we take a look and say it may be proper for the court to exercise its discretion. It clearly is the law that you should apply the law in time or in force at the time of the appeal, not at the time of the trial. So then the real question is whether we want to use the lack of a preservation of this argument post-trial as a gotcha for the trial counsel, or whether we want to make sure we correct the mischief that the economic loss rule was designed to prevent.
Mr. Connell, let me follow up with two of those things. First, on Hammond, what did Hammond say that prior case law did not?
Well, Hammond made it very clear and made it stated law that fraud and the performance of the contract is barred by the economic loss rule. The Town of Alma case, which was really the Supreme Court's law, the law in place at the time this case was tried, didn't address fraud claims or the kind of claims that we have in this case.
But the broad statement that a tort claim is barred would seem to clearly cover the fraud claim.
Well, except, Your Honor, that in the Town of Alma case, it was dicta, but in the Town of Alma case, the court cited two prior decisions, for the proposition that the economic loss rule is not all-encompassing. And one of those decisions, trying to remember the names of the decisions, but one of the decisions related to misrepresentation, fraudulent negligent misrepresentation, and the other one said common law fraud. And so at least in dicta, the Supreme Court signaled that, hey, there's going to be circumstances where we may not apply the economic loss rule to bar particular claims. And so I think counsel like myself that tries construction cases all the time, until Hammond came down, it was our understanding that the fraud cases were probably outside of the economic loss rule. And then in Hammond, this court went a little further and said fraud in the performance of a contract is barred. Fraud in the inducement of a contract may still be outside of the economic loss rule. And so it wasn't inappropriate for trial counsel to not be highlighted to that issue at trial and be focused on that issue at trial and preserving that, or in post-trial, because that law really did get reformulated through Hammond and Lakota. And
Let me stop you there for a minute. As I understand it, Hammond came down 2 days after the trial in this case?
Correct.
So what do we make of the fact that there was no reference to economic loss rule contention in post-trial motions?
Well, Your Honor, it would have been obviously ideal had trial counsel preserved that issue during the post-trial briefing. And again, I can only say that I don't think the preservation principle is designed as a gotcha defense for trial lawyers. And if you remember the time of trying cases, that time and trying the case and briefing the case post-trial, I can't explain why they didn't go out and search and see that there'd been a new decision handed down on the economic loss rule, but the way this case was prepared, the way the case was briefed pre-trial, that issue would not have been on the radar screen of trial counsel, because the law at that time really went to simple negligence claims, not fraud claims. I'm going to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. Edward Allen with the law firm of Pelton, Friedberg, Wilson & Hennessy on behalf of Ryan and Chrisanna Elliott. I'd like to begin by addressing that point on Hammond that you just asked counsel about, Your Honor. The Hammond case actually rejected the notion that this was new law. Hammond specifically found that there was no bright line rule that was set forth in the town of Alma. The court identified the two cases that the town of Alma discussed, and those were Brody and Formosa Plastics. The court identified that the Brody case involved alleged fraudulent misrepresentation, also allegedly created a contractual obligation. In other words, there was inducement for purposes of the contract. The second case was the Formosa Plastics, and in that case, the Hammond court identified the pertinent holding here as the alleged fraud in the inducement of the contract. So in the Hammond case, that argument was obviously made by counsel, and it was rejected by the court. I don't think that Hammond holds otherwise, and counsel could have and should have, if they intended to assert the affirmative defense of economic loss rule, maintain that from the get-go of trial. Initially, there was a negligence claim that was asserted by the Elliots. That claim was eventually dismissed. The economic loss rule was still maintained through the trial management order, but that was the last time it was identified. It wasn't raised during the trial briefing. It wasn't raised during the course of the trial, and it wasn't raised during post-trial periods of time. It was simply not brought up by counsel. Had the matter been brought up by counsel, the parties would have had the opportunity to address that. They would have had the opportunity to introduce additional evidence if necessary. The court would have been aware of the defense. The court perhaps could have provided additional findings of fact on that particular issue beyond what it did in this case. Now, you've seen the briefs, and of course, we argued from the beginning that we always intended to include a fraudulent inducement claim. In fact, we alleged that in the complaint. It's set forth in the trial management order, and it's stated in the opening statements that the Elliots maintained that there was fraudulent inducement in this case. Nevertheless, the appellants in this case did not raise the issue. They did not preserve the issue, and as is set forth in the answer brief, they therefore waived the right to maintain that defense. It would cause extreme prejudice to the appellees for them to have to go back and to argue these points and to potentially reopen this case with the trial court. The evidence was there, it was introduced, and it should have been raised at that time. I think there are a series of cases that were cited in the answer brief that address that particular issue, the Minto versus Lambert case, Borquez, Highland, and Blood. Borquez involved Workers' Compensation Act and exclusivity provision. In that particular case, the appellant, in fact, raised exclusivity in the affirmative defenses, identified it in the trial certificate, much like this case, but then failed to otherwise raise the point. The court held that by failing to make a timely objection The appellant had waived the right to have that matter heard on appeal. There are no circumstances in this case that make this exceptional. Counsel tries to argue that it is important or of the utmost importance and protects and preserves the distinction between contract and tort as one of the bases for having you here and raise this issue on your own. That's simply the economic loss rule. That's all that statement provides. Yes, it's an important distinction, but it wasn't raised and it wasn't preserved, so it can't be heard. The cases that are cited in the reply brief and the state cases in particular, the Roberts versus American Family case involved a matter that was disposed of by summary judgment. When the appellate court heard the matter or was taken up, it was determined that the court below had made an implicit finding regarding that particular issue. Likewise, in the Robinson case, it involved the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act, and the court again determined that there was an implicit determination regarding the particular issue before the court. Here, there was no implicit ruling. There was no finding. The issue was not raised. It wasn't by reference. There was nothing at all for the court to consider when it issued its order. And therefore, these cases are distinct and distinguishable from the case at bar. I'd also like to point out that the federal cases, the four, I believe, federal cases that were identified by counsel in the reply brief are also distinguishable. Those cases involve matters pertaining to the application of federal statute and involved constitutional issues. They were exceptional circumstances. The U.S. v. Novi case involved the question of authority to impose an enhanced sentence after there was an intervening change of law. Again, there is no intervening change of law in this case. The court in Hammond rejected that proposition. In the Lyons case, it involved the search of a vehicle, and the court found that, again, given the rights that were involved and whether it had authority, it would review the case, or whether the lower court had the authority to make a determination, it would review the case. In Trierweiler versus Croxton, the court was reviewing the application of the Erie Doctrine. Again, the court acknowledged that it was rare to address these cases on its own, but in that particular case, it decided to do so because the court made an implicit ruling at the lower level, and it involved a purely legal question for review. I think in each of these cases, there's something unique, there's something distinguishable, and there's something exceptional that the court could review and the court could address from the lower court's decision. Again, our case does not fall within these propositions as set forth in the reply brief. I'd like to talk next about the issue of the personal liability of Mr. Woodick. The Elliots acknowledge that the excessive lien statute is intended to penalize the entity or the person who files the lien. The Elliots also acknowledge that the lien was filed by JW Construction. However, Mr. Woodick, as its sole officer representative, was the individual who directed, authorized, and controlled, made the decision to file the lien. It was a knowing filing of the lien. He understood that it was excessive. The court found that that was the case, but he filed it anyway. We believe that in the case of violation of a statute of this sort, that the general proposition with regard to officer liability should be applied here.
And that's Mr. Allen, even if that applies, it wasn't pleaded, and I don't think you introduced any evidence on it below, did you?
Well, Your Honor, we did plead the claim against Mr. Woodick himself, and the complaint provides that we were seeking to hold Mr. Woodick personally liable for all wrongful acts committed by him. And then in the, I believe, set forth in the trial brief, we specifically identified that that included all damages, losses, and penalties that might be found against JW Construction.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was in the prayer for relief as opposed to in the claims for relief.
I believe it was contained in both, Your Honor. I could be wrong about that. I have to go back and look at that. I do know and do recall that it was specifically set forth in trial brief as part of the argument made to the court. It was also, I believe, a part of the evidence presented to the trial court that Mr. Woodick made the decision to file the lien, at least, and that the amounts that were being claimed were based upon the excessive amounts claimed in draw numbers 5 and 6.
Is it contained in the closing argument? Because the closings were written, as I recall.
The closings were proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law to the court. That is correct. And I can't tell you off the top of my head if it was set forth in that fashion. I believe that there is some reference to Mr. Woodick being personally liable for those matters, but I'd have to go back and double check the record.
What's the statutory basis, either on the language of the statute or in what evidence there is in the record for holding holding Mr. Woodick personally liable here?
Well, the theory, Your Honor, is that Mr. Woodick was the one who directed and authorized and controlled the determination to file this excessive lien.
That's not what the statute says. Statute says
the
person who files it.
The person who files, any person who files a lien knowing that it's in excess of what amount is actually due and owing. And what we're trying to establish or trying to argue here is that by filing that lien, in a closely held corporation, by filing the lien, the owner of the company should be held liable and accountable for that action.
Does that extend to the secretary of the corporation that attests to the signature of the president?
No, it wouldn't extend to just anyone who files. It would be the individual who knowingly filed the excessive lien, or more particularly, as was the case in Packard, the person who directs, authorizes, and controls that decision to have the excessive lien filed. The problem is this: if there isn't a deterrent effect for the owner of the business, all the small contractors out there, they could file liens against properties, and excessive liens against the properties, and there'd be no repercussions for that. There'd be no ramification, be no deterrent effect.
Assessment of attorney fees against the corporate entity and the invalidity of the lien isn't enough?
Well, in certain circumstances, no. Because there may be empty vessels. They may not have, they may be insolvent companies. And I think in the Snow case, you know, I recognize that the circumstances pertain to a common law a claim, but it's Snowden provided that to permit an agent of a corporation in carrying on its business to inflict wrong and injuries upon others and then shield himself from liability behind his vicarious character would often both sanction and encourage the perpetuation of flagrant and wanton injuries by agents of insolvent and irresponsible corporations. But I think that proposition applies here.
Isn't your remedy to file a claim for alter ego, and that wasn't done here?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. You don't always have an alter ego scenario in which to pursue. Someone may dot their I's and cross their T's, and there may not be an ability to pursue an alter ego case, not to mention the fact that these cases like Huang versus Arbus and Snowden versus Taggart provide that where an officer directs, controls the wrongful conduct, the alter ego theory is not necessary. It does away with the action of having to pierce the corporate veil. With the amount of time I have left, I just want to touch on a couple of other points. One is with regard to the excessive lien standard. I think it's set forth in our answer brief fairly clearly. For some reason, the reply brief seems to ignore the responses as well as the record cited. I think the lower court clearly applied the correct standard. The court did determine and find that JW and Woodick were aware that the liens that were filed were in excess of the amounts that were due and owing. It wasn't just because the Ellis had paid portions of those invoices or draws that had been submitted to them, but it was also premised on Mr. Woodick's admission that certain materials had been billed for, and he advised the Elliots that they were not intended for the project and were not provided to the project. There were also issues involved with portions of the claimed lien that were inflated and excessive or were double billed in cases, and there was ample evidence regarding that particular point as well. That's contained in the answer brief. On JW's breach of contract claim, the court actually addressed both contracts, I believe, in Section B of its order, and in fact, actually utilized a fairly large portion of the proposed findings of fact that were submitted by counsel for the appellant. Nevertheless, the court determined that it was JW that breached the contracts and that the Elliots had, in fact, rightfully terminated JW. So I think that that point was addressed, and the determination was made that the Elliots did not breach the contract. On the issue of the support for the damages, there was some disagreement with regard to the fixed price of the contract or whether this was not a fixed price. Frankly, it doesn't matter in this case. What we're dealing with here is a claim of fraud. Trimble provides that with a claim of fraud, the damages are the actual value versus what was represented to the harmed party. And in this case, that's the standard the court used. The court determined that the damages were set forth, and I believe it was $70,000 or $87,000 in this case. There's ample evidence to support those calculations and arguments set forth in the answer brief on that particular point as well. In the end, the Elliott's request that the lower court's decision be affirmed in its entirety and ask for their fees and costs in having to defend against this appeal. There is plenty of record for the court to review. There's a lot of testimony regarding these issues in terms of the fraud and the inducement, as well as the administration of the contract. And there's also ample evidence in relation to the damages that were awarded in this case. Thank you.
Three quick points on the excessive lien personal liability issue. Number one, we just heard that the Elliots concede that JW Construction filed the lien. They simply say that Mr. Riddick directed the filing of the lien. But the statute says any person who files the lien, not any person who directs the filing of the lien, can be liable. Number two, this statute has a knowing intent component. You have to knowingly file an excessive lien. By definition, corporations don't know anything. There is someone who will always have, the evidence will be that someone knew that the lien was excessive, which would mean we have personal liability in every case if you accepted their construct. Number three, he complains that we need to protect against small, closely held corporations or insolvent corporations. That's what alter ego law is all about. If you can break through the corporate shield and show it's a sham and that they're simply alter egos, then you can impose personal liability as if they were the corporation. But here, the corporation filed a lien, and the only way you get personal liability is through a finding of alter ego. It was never argued, and the court didn't make that finding. On the economic loss rule, it is interesting that you didn't hear any challenge to the substance of the rule, only the preservation issue. So had we not had an issue about whether it was preserved on appeal, there'd be no question here that fraud in the inducement claims found by the trial court would be improper. And let me back up and give you the big picture. Why it's a real mischief in this case, what happened at trial. Okay, we know from the evidence, from Mr. Schwarzkopf's testimony, who is the expert for the plaintiff, that the Elliott spent about $500,000 using his highest number above the contract value to finish the job. We also know from the court's finding at the court's finding in her findings below that of the amount that the Elliott spent to finish, $700,000 of it at a minimum were for things they added to the project after they fired JW Construction. He was terminated halfway through this job. So what does that mean? They were over the contract value of $1.9 million by $500,000, having spent $700,000 on new stuff. So what did they get? They finished this contract for $200,000 less than they bargained to have it built by Mr. Rodick. They already have profited by the termination of JW Construction. And now we're adding insult to injury by finding fraud claims. $80,000, the court says, were for excessive billings. Excessive billing is a breach of contract. It isn't damages unless at the end of the day you didn't get what you bargained for. Billing excessively beyond cost during the contract clearly would be a breach, and the trial court found that it was. That doesn't mean the Elliots were damaged, either in fraud or in contract. Until we look at the end of the day, what did it take them to finish the job? Did they end up spending more than they had bargained to spend? And the answer is no. In fact, they spent at least $200,000 less, which is why the trial court said, if we look at this in contract, there's no damages. So we extended the total liability and added $80,000 of damages out of thin air. Then we made Mr. Roddick personally liable for those damages by concluding that he participated in the tort that isn't recognized under the economic loss rule. None of the cases, the Borges case and the Minto case, had the unusual circumstance we have here, which is an intervening change of the law. This court should step in and enforce the construct of the economic loss rule to return this liability to where it belongs. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments this afternoon, Counsel. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. We need to change the composition of the panel at this time for the next arguments. So we're going to take a brief recess. Dale, can we announce a 5-minute recess?
Recess.